So especially now when our nation is so bitterly riven about everything, who we are, what we are, what we stand for, who we stand with, what future we believe in, what past we celebrate, how we treat each other, what we deserve from each other. Especially now, as sexual scandals are breaking out every day about both those we deplore and those we have esteemed, while our nation sits on the sidelines at climate change conferences, as gunfire rings throughout our cities, in the heart of our city, while the way to racial reconciliation remains so challenged and challenging, as wealth and business again reign as the supreme values among our nation's executive leaders, it seems utterly clear that forgiveness is and will be required. If we are ever to get through this wrenching time. Some people are exhilarated, some are despairing, some are determined, some are desperate, some are hopeful, some are hurt. Almost everyone is, it seems, angry. Certainly I am angry. So is it really time to be talking about forgiveness? I mean, forgiveness and abundance are our themes for this month to explore, but do they really fit with this time and this context? Well, you know my answer is going to be yes. But here is why. Forgiveness matters most in the hardest times. And for me, this is not, let me be clear, for me, this is not about putting away anger and just saying, there should be no anger, only forgiveness. I don't have a problem with anger. I don't even have a problem with anger as a religious value. The question is what we do with it. And studies show that fear makes us biddable, but anger makes us feel strong. Anger makes us feel able to get in the game. But it can't be the sum of what our game is. And so, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu put it in his own riven nation of South Africa, without forgiveness, there is no future. And as one of our own great leaders in another time of conflict and violence here at home said, forgiveness is not an occasional act. It must be a permanent attitude. And that, of course, was Reverend Dr. King. So in talking about forgiveness and even abundant forgiveness, I am not talking about giving up, and I am certainly not talking about giving in. Having talked a couple of months ago about the dynamics of interpersonal forgiveness, I want to talk today about what some of the larger aspects and implications of forgiveness can be, about what is really going to be required if we are ever to forge a new path into being better with each other. Because what is particular to each of us and how we are with each other is also much bigger than that. Poised between last week's elections and our upcoming national holiday, what matters to us as individuals also speaks to our capacity to be a better United States of America. Isn't it already terribly, and I use the word advisedly, terribly obvious that we can't be, that we will never be the nation we claim to be by imposing our ways, our understandings, our identities, our priorities, our fears and insecurities on each other. And I do not just mean their ways and priorities. I do also mean ours, because in the end, it's about the imposing that is the issue. Maybe it is sad. Maybe it's good. It's probably both. That there are a lot of stories and sources to remind us of what is possible for a people and for individuals, even when things seem unbearable and, yes, unforgivable. And the one I want to share with you this morning is called Revenge, A Story of Hope. It is a memoir that was written by a journalist named Laura Blumenfeld. It came out a while ago in 2002. So here's the story that she relays. In 1986, her father, an American rabbi, was visiting Jerusalem, and he was shot in the head by a Palestinian. It was part of a campaign to kill tourists and draw attention to the Palestinian cause. And amazingly, her father was not killed. In fact, over a long time, he ended up recovering fully from what was a glancing shot. But Laura, his daughter, could not let go of the shooting, and she became obsessed with it. And ultimately, she decided, many years later, to dedicate the first year of her marriage to living in Israel and pursuing the story of what had happened to the shooter. In fact, not only to learn about him, but also to study revenge, because what she wanted from this man who had tried to kill her father was vengeance. When I first read this book, I tried hard, as a woman who adores her father, I tried hard to imagine doing what Laura did, because this is a true story. She wanted vengeance. And that's what her goal was. And I found it hard, though I can certainly hold a grudge, I found it hard to imagine going to live in a country with the intent of pursuing vengeance, serious vengeance, against one individual. But I haven't been through what she went through. I know that many times we may be shocked when some terrible, violent, ugly thought enters our head. And all of us have had that happen at some time or other. And we may feel repelled at it. We may feel repelled at ourselves. We may wish we had some kind of soap for our brains and our souls because of the ugliness and filth that we just thought ourselves. But that was not Laura's reaction. Rather than struggling to overcome the violence and anger of her reaction, she leaned into it, she considered it, and she ended up traveling the world to educate herself about it. Palermo, Sicily, to learn about revenge from the mafia. There in the cradle, as she puts it, of the vendetta. Albania, where they have a code, a canon, an actual book that is readily found in many homes of rules for revenge. Iran, where she studied Sharia law about vengeance. Her own Jewish heritage, where the Hebrew word for revenge, nekama, is linked etymologically to another word, kum, which means rising. Which reminds us through language that part of the appeal of revenge is that it is a most basic form of self-assertion. And she looked at it in the business world, where one successful businessman declared that getting even is a management tool used as both reward and punishment. Look at all these places that are just embracing this, where it is the norm. Laura's thought deepens along the way. She comes to believe that revenge is always a contrivance by which we give ourselves illusions of control. Really, that it's about playing God. And she explores the nuances of language that soften or legitimize some forms of vengeance over others. Think about reprisal versus retribution versus revenge. She notices that U.S. newspaper headlines about reprisal by the U.S., targeting a factory in Sudan and terrorist camps in Afghanistan after U.S. embassies were bombed in Kenya and Tanzania, and compares those to the same newspaper's headlines about revenge attacks promised by Osama bin Laden following the U.S. reprisals. And when she says that, don't you recognize that? Her studies take her to Athens, Greece, to visit the temple of Nemesis, the goddess of retribution for evil deeds. And notice that Nemesis's name translates in English, right, not to justice. We use it rather to indicate opponent and avenger when we talk of someone being a nemesis. As Laura's journey unfolds, she begins to explore beyond the rules or forms of revenge to different categories of revenge. Constructive revenge, which changes power equations by building oneself up rather than putting others down. And the strategies that go with revenge. Among the newer people of South Sudan, feuding families cannot eat or drink from each other's dishes. And Laura realizes that this is necessary because it prevents them from eating together, from developing the bonds that are engendered by hospitality and sharing and talking, because those could lead to the dangerous development of discovering commonalities. And that is a step down the road away from revenge toward relationship. She writes, a shared identity threatens the life of a blood feud. Revenge depends upon the externalization of hate. It is something that you do to others, never to your own kind. And then she studies suffering and choices around revenge closer to home in Israel and Palestine. She talks with a man of mixed Jewish-Arab heritage whose brother had been killed by an Arab gang decades before and whose wife, decades later, is shot and killed by a Palestinian. And after both deaths, the man chooses relationship and connection over vengeance. His dual heritage and life choices are a testament to the insight of a Middle East proverb, if you want revenge, dig two graves, one for your enemy and one for yourself. But the man who has lost his brother and later his wife is human, after all. He has a sign taped above his desk, love your enemies, it really gets on their nerves. And when he sees Laura notice the sign, he says, it works. She learns from a psychologist at Hebrew University that he believes the only satisfying substitute for revenge is true acknowledgement, which he notes is more than regret, it is accepting responsibility. And while the idea is rooted in an individual's wish for retribution, the psychologist thinks that it has implications on a national level, between Israelis and Palestinians, who both need to acknowledge they have done wrong and acknowledge each other's legitimacy. The whole time Laura is on this search for understanding regarding vengeance, she is also trying to pave her way towards her own path of revenge on the shooter, whose name is Omar Khatib. He was found and arrested and charged and sentenced for the shooting and has spent decades already in prison. He was sentenced for decades in prison. He's already spent years there, and that is not enough for her. But at the same time, she is not sure what else she wants, to shame him, to throttle him, or at least shake him by the shirt collar. She imagines all of these things and more. So she's being very specific about what she needs in what she imagines. She thinks about shooting him, or about shooting his father as he shot hers. She is so consumed that there is nothing too terrible to think about. She goes to his family's house, and she meets them, portraying herself simply as some American journalist who's interested in understanding their story on their terms. And she goes back, and she goes back, and she begins to matter to them. and they begin to matter to her. And the shooter becomes a person to her. She begins, still as just the journalist his family now knows and vouches for, to correspond with Omar. And over time, she seeks more and more to understand how he thinks about what he did, how he justifies it, whether, and this is the most important thing to her father, who, of course, is, after all, the one who was actually shot, whether Omar would do it again, and whether, and this is the most important thing to Laura, whether Omar is sorry. And her fantasies of hurtful or violent revenge begin to fade, but what might take their place remains cloudy and intangible for all her continual seeking and reflection. Omar's letters back to Laura are smuggled out of the prison on onion skin paper that is folded countless times and placed in tiny capsules that are swallowed or otherwise snuck out by his family when they go to visit him. In the beginning, his writing is filled with familiar declarations of belief and justification for his actions. But over time, as Omar and Laura, who still has not revealed her last name or her true interest in the case, as they exchange information about themselves, he reveals more about his understandings and concerns, and even his wish for diplomatic resolutions. This unfolds during the time when Ehud Barak was the Israeli prime minister and palpable steps towards peace and two-state solutions were evolving, which is not at all the case now. Laura tells Omar she has found the man he shot. Of course, this is her dad. That the man is a good person who has worked for peace and been sympathetic to the Palestinian people. Eventually, Omar shares with her something that maybe could not have come into being without her outreach, his developing regret, and his ultimate sense that he would not make the same choice now that he made as a young man. And this shifts something in Laura. And the nature of that shift becomes clear when Laura comes anonymously to a hearing where Israeli judges are deliberating about whether to release Omar early because of health complications he's having from very serious asthma. Laura urges the judges to release him, and she reveals before the judges and Omar's family, who know her so well and yet still not at all, and before Omar himself, her true identity as the daughter of the man he shot. She isn't even planning to do this when she goes into the room that day. But this is what happens, the big reveal. It's like a scene out of a movie, and everybody's shocked. But this is real. And the judges release Omar, and he goes home to his family, and he starts his life again. And soon afterward, her father receives a letter from Omar who writes, "God is good to me that he gets me know your Laura. She was the mirror that made me see your face as a human person deserved to be admired and respected." And Laura writes, that, in the end, was her revenge. It ended up not being an eye for an eye, and not even turn the other cheek. She discovered a third way, which was transformation. And the conclusion she came to is that revenge doesn't have to be about destroying your enemy. It might mean transforming him and yourself, because it is not possible for one of them to have changed without the other. The change required the relationship, and the impact of the relationship on them both in order to happen at all. Obviously, I'm spending so much time telling you this story because I think it has implications for us now. In the midst of one of the oldest and most poisonous conflicts in the world, understanding and relationship have been created. Laura goes with her father years later to visit the Khatib family, and clearly what has happened is still important, still central to both families. They have created ties that bind, that last. Even amidst the betrayal and the violence of the escalating situation between Israel and Palestine. This is not some parable of hope for those people or those nations over there. It's not a story of hope at all. It's not a story of hope at all unless we see ourselves in the story. If people in Israel and Palestine do not see themselves, it is not their story either, and it's not their hope. If we here do not see ourselves, our own grudges and reasons, and the violence that we do to each other, then it is not our story, and it will never be our hope. Will we guard, like the newer people, against sharing or breaking bread with those against whom we must stand? What about that insidious capacity for hospitality and connection to create bonds? If people can forgive, regret, change, grow, connect, commit, care across all they have been through and done to each other, then it can be done. It can be done. Any of us might do that. And if it can be done, then we must renew our commitment to see, even in those we dislike or disrespect, a human being to be admired and respected, because that can never be a one-way street. None of us has the luxury in these days of being faint-hearted. We just can't do it. Not now. Not with things as they are. But also, none of us is helpless. And we are even less helpless together. So feel what you are feeling about all the challenges we face. Feel every bit of it and do what you need to do about all that you feel. And whenever you are ready, we have bridges to build. And we have understanding to establish and messages to give to and receive from those we do not understand, who do not understand us. We cannot live in any sense despite each other. We have got to live with each other. And so we must, and so we will find our ways forward. A lot of bad things. The Standing Rock confrontation and police killings of our black neighbors and friends and family members and domestic terrorism. A lot of those things happened while a president I admired and worked for was in office. And good things have happened even in the past year, including powerful affirmations of the rights of immigrants, whatever their legal status, and of the rights of women, and of the rights of Muslims. Most recently, a gun control bill just enacted here in Rhode Island. There are many ways forward for us as a faith community, as citizens of this state and of this country. And some of the ways will be forged with strength, and some of them will be forged with resistance, and some will be forged with courage, and some will be forged with openness, and some will be forged with gentleness, and some with questions, and some with care, and some with compromise, and some with compassion, and some will be fueled even by anger. Every way forward that ultimately creates collaboration or understanding, every way forward inevitably requiring growing ourselves and our numbers until we win what we want. All those will inevitably require at some point, forgiveness. Forgiveness is not a weakness. Forgiveness, when it is allied with vision and commitment, is a rare kind of strength. I wish I had a crystal ball to show me the way to what we want and need to be, or maybe a telescope, because it seems so far away. One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. That has ever been the promise held up by our government. And we cannot let it go. We cannot let it go. So we will not let it go. May we be wise and strong, wiser and stronger in the years before us. May we remember the astounding truth that anyone can journey from vengeance to hope and from loathing to love. May we remember that this is not about our enemies, but that this is for ourselves and all that we hold sacred. May we remember, as surely as we are here together this morning, that we are blessed. So blessed. We have gifts, and we have strength, and we are here. Look at each other. I see all of you in this space. We are here in this time, on this journey, thank God. Together. Amen.